I always forget to let the soundtrack and my intro music lead me in. How's everybody doing? I did not show my normal video intro today because we're running a little late, and I wanted to make sure we got right into our guest today. But there's the end of the intro. I wanted to say, hopefully everybody's staying safe, everybody's staying healthy, everybody is staying inside right now, obviously, with everything going on. And this isn't the type of show to get political or to start talking about all the things that I truly believe in, which is peaceful protesting, which I believe should be happening and is happening. But there's a lot of looting, a lot of crazy stuff going on, even down here where my office is. And so I want to just make sure everyone knows that you should be safe, you should be healthy, you should be staying inside. And let's get everybody calmed down here. And let's get back to the point where we can actually work on a very restrained and very peaceful protest against the horrible things that have happened between the police and the African-American community for many, many years, regardless of also what happened last week. So that's what I wanted to say about that. I don't want to get way into the weeds on everything because, you know, that's not this type of show. Chicago Music Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, chicagojazz.com. But I am glad because our guest today, John Bailey, came out with a new recording, and this sort of all ties together. And I like the fact that we're going to be talking to John about this because the name of the recording is Can You Imagine? And John, welcome to the show and thank you for being on. And I think that what we're going to talk about today in regards to your latest recording that came out in January actually still is very, very important today. And it ties in perfectly, but we're going to talk specifically about this incredible recording you have. So how are you doing?
I'm doing okay, Mike.
As good as we can do, right? As good as we can do here.
Yeah. We're hanging in and we're fighting the fight, man.
So now, for everybody to know, John's located in New York. He's not in downtown, but he's up in, not in Manhattan or one of the boroughs, right? You're just outside of the city, right?
No, I live in New York City, but I'm not there now. My wife and child and I, we vacated the city March 13th on Friday night when we lost all of our work and my son got kind of locked out of school. And we have a little place up here in Dutchess County outside of Poughkeepsie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we are.
Well, excellent. Well, I'm glad you could join us today. And I'm glad we're talking about this incredible recording. As I said before we came on, I listened to a majority of the tracks. I really dig it. And I think that just listening to the tracks, we're going to talk about the concept behind it, and I want you to go in depth into that. But I mean, I can tell that Dizzy Gillespie and a lot of these other famous, world famous trumpet players that all of the history of jazz trumpet has been influenced you, because I could hear a lot of different styles, a lot of different genres throughout this entire recording, which I thought was really interesting, a good listen to listen to. So why don't we talk though about the concept behind this recording, and how it came about.
Well, around about 2016, I witnessed, as we all witnessed, the pendulum swinging after, let's face it, the white or part of white America's reaction to 8 years of a black president. And I couldn't help but thinking about this, even though this pendulum has swung and the white supremacists who were not really in the forefront weren't really being heard are now being heard. And oh man, there they are. And we knew they were there all along, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
So here we go. Right. So I kept thinking about Dizzy because it turns out that Dizzy Gillespie, the great jazz trumpet player, John Burks Gillespie, ran for president in 1964 for real. And this is a reminder that we live in a great country because had enough people written his name into the ballot, John Burks Gillespie would have become the first black president in 1964.
That's right.
And so what I kept thinking about over and over and over is, would we have, with him serving as the catalyst that Barack Obama served as, all those years before, would we be further along as a culture today? And that became sort of the theme of the record.
Mm-hmm.
Because Dizzy Gillespie was a great humanitarian. Dizzy Gillespie ran for president to fight for world peace, to fight for racial equality in America, to fight for and to raise money for CORE.
Mm-hmm.
So these were all great causes. And lest we forget that Dizzy was the first jazz ambassador, in fact, from 1957 to America. So this is then later on, of course, he had the United Nations Orchestra. And we're talking about an immensely talented human being who came of age from South Carolina to New York City and revolutionized American music. Not just bebop, but Latin jazz as well. He's considered the godfather of Latin jazz.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the premise of the record. And I just started thinking about, you know, the tune I Can Dream, Can't I by Sammy Fain, which Clifford recorded in the 50s. And thinking that, you know what, this is a big dream of mine. Like, this is a dreamy fantasy. So I'm going to make a song, and I'm going to call it, I'm going to use the changes of I Can Dream, Can't I, and I'm going to call the song President Gillespie's Birthday Song. That's how this album was born. It ended up being turning into a suite in three movements. But there it is in a nutshell.
Well, I'll tell you, it's quite a concept, by the way. I mean, I love it, you know, but really when you think about it and what you just described, and I mean, you know, obviously, you know, myself being a drummer, jazz drummer and everything, obviously, you know, I've listened to, you know, all of Dizzy's recordings and followed him and stuff, but you brought up a great point that I think sometimes gets lost maybe on the casual music fan or even, you know, a jazz fan that's not totally in depth into Dizzy's whole life. But boy, he was so inclusive, and he could have been that guy that just played concerts, did whatever he did, and would have been hugely successful. But he went out of his way to include people and to constantly seek out other people and other ways and other cultures to include them with him in order to broaden their listening ability, right? I mean, the whole when he, you know, went to Cuba and everything. I mean, he really opened up that entire country to the United States, because before that, it really wasn't as prominent.
Yeah, he really understood that this is really world music.
Yeah,
you know, that it's American music, and American music represents world music, the mm-hmm. melting pot of everyone from every culture coming together and sharing their musical ideas and making a new art form out of it. And he was one of the central figures in it.
Yeah. He was a catalyst of a lot of things, and you're right. I mean, that's really truly what he ended up doing. And I mean, just, you know, without going down the wormhole here, but I mean, just think about all of the artists that might not have been really known to any of us if it wasn't for Dizzy, for him bringing them into his band and mentoring them. And, you know, and then they went on to have hugely successful careers. So, I mean, just the scope of what Dizzy did, just from a music standpoint, no matter what genre it was, it's incredible.
I mean, you just, Lee Morgan, you just start with him.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people for a long time thought that, you know, that until they looked carefully or read the liner notes, that was Dizzy playing in the front of Manteca mm-hmm. at Newport. I wasn't. That was 17-year-old Lee Morgan.
Isn't that unbelievable?
So a great example of that. And of course, Dizzy, much more than just a trumpet player, right? Much more than just a composer, much more than just a great American. Mm-hmm. He was, those of us who are of a certain age, we actually got to meet Dizzy, and we actually got to like see him on television along with Ella and all these great, great artists. And anytime Dizzy walked into a room, he was incredibly charismatic mm-hmm. and he lit up the room. You know,
yeah,
everybody was a better person for him being in the room.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway,
well, I remember just since we're talking about Dizzy, I happened to be lucky enough to work with Joe Siegel, the founder of the Chicago Jazz Showcase.
Absolutely.
And he and I did his book, which came out 2 years ago. And so I was with Joe for 2 years working on this. And he threw a birthday party for Dizzy at the old club on Rush Street for, you know, because he knew Dizzy forever. And oh my gosh, did he have stories and stuff. But I mean, Dizzy was so approachable to everybody. And I think that, you know, it just passed on the jazz tradition to a lot of people that might not have been influenced by it. So the fact that you've got this new recording called Can You Imagine, It's really an incredible concept. But before we came on, we were talking about it's not really a tribute to Dizzy. It was the Can You Imagine, thinking about that. So why don't we talk a little bit about the tunes that are on this and some of the, you know, how did you go about developing the repertoire for this?
Well, I wanted to write three or four tunes. I ended up writing the Suite, which is really three tunes, and then a couple of others. So as far as my originals, you've got the Blues House, and which, by the way, was one of Dizzy's campaign promises. If you got elected president, he would change the name of the White House to the Blues House. So that's the Blues House, which
reading in some info on the album. I mean, was he really thinking about having Miles Davis be the head of the CIA?
Yeah, Miles is head of the CIA. Louis Armstrong is head of agriculture. And that was pretty funny. Of course, inundated with just tons of humor, and then very serious as a heart attack. Just to encapsulate Dizzy. Dizzy would crack a joke, you know, just like Louis Armstrong, by the way. He would crack a joke. And then when he put the horn to his face, anytime you see him play, he's serious as a heart attack.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
You know, I mean, absolutely stoic, like a rock, you know, and he's playing straight ahead. He's moving around while he's playing.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? That tells everything right there. So anyway, Pebbles in the Pocket. This is a tune I wrote that I just wanted to write a fast modal tune and have a little fun with it. And the title came about because of a friend of mine that's on this record who referred to pebbles of wisdom that he had received from his parents, his deceased father in particular. And he was talking about, oh, he just kind of carries around these pebbles of wisdom. So the tune is Pebbles of Wisdom, you know, which we should all heed.
Absolutely.
And then the President Gillespie Suite is a humanitarian candidate, obviously. Road to the Blues House, featuring great Earl McIntyre on bass trombone, plunder trombone, because he used to play with Taj Mahal, and he's got a whole thing. We featured him on that, which is a vamp, and the backgrounds for that movement are Volunteered Slavery by Ross on Roland Kirk. And the theme to that you hear as a background, and you see Do Yourself a Favor. Educate your mind. Get yourself together. Hey, there ain't much time. That's a Stevie Wonder lyric from where I'm coming from. And then we start quoting all the cabinet picks, you know. A little walk-in in there, a little Duke Ellington. Then we get into President Gillespie's birthday song, which again, it's just a celebration. We have a little fun. Tune number three, Touch of Revive. This is a beautiful tune by Victor Lewis. Let's see. Oh, Ballad from Oro Incenso y Mira. This is a tune that Chico O'Farrell wrote, which is a part of a suite on an album called Afro-Cuban Jazz Moods by Machito. And I took this, I actually had an opportunity to play this with the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra at the Apollo. And I just fell in love with this thing. I got like hang 10 out there in front of the big orchestra and played this inspired, man. It was something else. So I extracted the ballad and made, you know, basically Chico's arrangement. It's basically just a transcription. Stacy Dillard wrote this beautiful tune, Elite State of Mind, which he wrote back in 2006, and he repurposed for this record. So that's a really beautiful one, too. Valso Rancho. This is where you have to check out Elise Regina and the music of Brazil. So I always put one of Elise's tunes from her songbook. It's not her tune. It's Frances Hines' tune. But we did a little transcription, and I owed that one to Cesar Mariano, who was her husband and accompanist. And we let Stacy go crazy at the end. From the Heart is another Victor Lewis original. And that's a great one that really goes back. And again, it's because he wrote this one years ago. He was working on it. And he wrote it after hearing Ross on Roland Kirk play. So this is how it's all kind of tying in. Now, the last tune on the record is People. People made famous by Barbra Streisand. But what very few people know, Mike, is that this tune was recorded live at Carnegie Hall at Newport Jazz Festival in 1973. at the very end of a concert by Ella Fitzgerald. Just Ella and Tommy Flanagan
as
a duo. And let me tell you, Lucille Armstrong is in the front row. And she does her arrangement of it. She finishes up and you can hear or feel her pointing to Lucille while she's singing the lyrics at the end. So I had this record as a kid because my sisters growing up had, you know, they were singers and musicians and stuff. And so I've listened to this thing since I was about 11. And I decided I'm just going to do a transcription of this version of People.
Mm-hmm.
As an homage to Ella and to tie into this record to the whole concept, which is, hey, listen, there's some beautiful people out there we can vote for president in 2020 and have the opportunity to do so many, many years ago as well.
Mm-hmm.
And people who are interested in social justice, people who are interested in world peace, people are interested in having a world culture like Dizzy did.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really letting me go on and on. I should let you chime in.
Well,
here.
No, it's fascinating because I think it's interesting, you know, the whole concept of it, but the fact that you've got, well, Victor Lewis contributed two tracks, right? Two tunes to this recording. So it was really almost a collaboration on your part with the different guys that you were working with. Are these all, talk a little bit about the guys in the band, Victor Lewis, obviously.
Well,
but,
yeah. You know. Well, first of all the records that I would like to make and have, I've only made two records as a leader, but I always like it to be kind of like a band record,
mm-hmm.
instead of like a record where it's like, here's a trumpet player out front and you're gonna you know, right. we're going to showcase him and I'm going to solo on every tune and it's all my original composition. come on. I mean, there's some great musicians in the world. Let's make a band record. So, you know, Victor's been on both of my records, and I just love him. You know, I mean, anybody who knows Victor knows he's got the same spirit as Dizzy did. You know, it's just an absolutely unpretentious, beautiful human being who is all about team ball when it plays. And those are his words, too. Team mm-hmm. ball. You know, we have to play the music together. Whatever happens, happens, man. You know, it's gonna be great if we're all on the same page.
That's right.
You know,
that's right. What a concept, right?
You know, you're, as a drummer, you know it. Stacy's just got the most beautiful sound in the world, and he's an incredibly natural musician. And every time I play with him, there's magic happens every time. You know, I need him by my side.
Yeah.
And for that matter, if I'm going to expand to a sextet, I need Stafford Hunter on the other side of me because he's another really incredible intuitive musician. And they're great ensemble players and they're great soloists and they're team players.
Mm-hmm.
So then you get to the rhythm section, Edsel. How can you go wrong with Edsel Gomez, right?
That's right.
Puerto Rican guy who lived in Brazil for 10 years, you know, and lives in New York and plays jazz music. Yeah. Okay. Get me Edsel Gomez. Now, the bass player on this record is really interesting, has a really interesting history. I've known him since we were 17 years old, but he was playing tenor saxophones. I'm talking about Mike Karn. Mike Karn was a tenor saxophone player for years and years. And along the way, he just found himself evolving as a bass player. He became a bass player. And he was hard to get. I almost couldn't get him because you know what his gig is?
What's that?
He works with John Pizzarelli.
Oh, okay.
He's John Pizzarelli's bass player.
He's constantly on the road, usually. Right?
Constantly on the road. Yeah. I mean, I had to like extract him like to the rehearsals and the, you know, and then off he was, you know, again, you know, on the road. So then we have my special guest, Earl McIntyre playing a couple mm-hmm. tunes and playing tuba on the chorale of Oro and Cecilia Mira, and Janet Axelrod playing flute on a couple of the tunes, just melodies and stuff like that.
How
so that rounds it out.
How important, I mean, all right, so looking over your bio, you've been on over 75 recordings, right? I mean, two of yours.
Yeah, but 77 now.
Yeah, but I mean, when you're looking at that, all of that recording experience, I mean, obviously you've come into you know, a thing, and here's the parts, play this, here it is, in and out. And then you've probably been a part of different recordings with different groups that it's more along the lines of what you did with your recording. But I always feel, especially with jazz, especially with something that's like this, where there's a lot of improvisation, a lot of playing off of each other, a lot of, you know, cooperation to get the same thing happening and everything moving in the right direction and everybody being able to be as creative as possible because everybody is supporting them. I mean, how important is that as a leader to make sure you've got those right guys around you to get the most out of the song selections that you're selecting for the recording? Because I'm always curious for somebody like yourself who's won 2 Grammys and everything. I mean, you've been on all these recordings, but I mean, there has to be some recordings that you probably left the recording session and went, you know, it could have been a lot better if we were all kind of chiming in, because there might have been a few things I might have changed, but I didn't feel comfortable saying something, as opposed to the setting that you set up for this recording where you're probably like, yeah, you know, everybody's kind of giving and taking and pushing the music forward.
Yeah, you know, as a sideman for so many years, you see all kinds of different band leaders, and you know, I was a sideman for 30 years mm-hmm. plus, and so you see people who don't lead enough, you see people who are taskmasters, and that has an effect on the music, and then of course what you just said here, you know, when the after effect of, you know, the immediate after effect of a take.
Yeah.
You know, you do take one and you have different reactions from different people. You got the disappointed guy. You've got the guy who's enamored with himself. You've got the school of people who immediately want to go on the booth and listen to themselves. And then you've got the other guys who are just going to go smoke a cigarette, you know. And I've taken the latter of that. I don't really like to go in because, you know, paralysis by analysis, man. I mean, you go in, start critiquing yourself. Well, then what are you going to get next take? Maybe if you're not really super sound, you know, psychologically, you might be more technically proficient, but less soulful, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you got to weigh in all of those things. You got to be a leader and taskmaster when it's necessary. And you got to let people play.
Yeah.
You know, which I would always like to take the latter of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let people play, but know what you want. You know, have specific ideas, be organized, know exactly what you want. Don't be afraid. Because Victor Lewis told me something. The first thing he told me before we played a note in my band, let me know if you hear something that you absolutely hate. And this was almost by virtue to loosen me up, to say, mm-hmm. listen, man, I'm work for you. You know, I want to know what you want.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. You know, it's interesting because I've asked this question to a few musicians who have played with, well, for an example, just recently, John Primer, right? Who was a world famous blues guitarist, who was Muddy Waters guitar player for 15 years and Willie Dixon and all that. And I asked him, I said, you know, how, when you walked in to play with Muddy and you were playing, I mean, were you like worried about, like, hey man, you know, am I playing the right stuff, am I thinking about it or whatever? And you know, he basically told me, you know, if I really played something that wasn't happening, I'd hear about it and I would fix it.
Exactly. Yeah, and you probably shouldn't ask, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it would behoove you to stay silent.
Exactly. Yeah, right. But you know, it's interesting to me because somebody like you, I mean, when I was reading up on your bio, I mean, your first gig was, well, in college, I don't think it was your first gig, but you're playing with Buddy Rich, right? You were playing Buddy.
Yeah, my first road gig was a brief stint with Buddy Rich. And by the way, Tom Garling was on the road with me.
Oh,
so
was he?
Shout out to him.
Oh man, yeah, we love Tom Garling, man. He's the best.
Favorite musicians in the world, man. And not, you know, I mean, one of my favorite trombone players beyond that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So, no kidding. Well,
he was out there, man.
Well, he's been on the road with a lot of different bands. Boy, I didn't realize he was on the Buddy band with you. That's amazing.
Yeah, I lasted a couple of months, and then there were 4 of us that came on the band, and they fired all 4 of us.
And, which for those of you that are for those of you that think that that's weird, it was Buddy Rich's band. It was not weird. I'm surprised you made 4 months because I talked to people, and they're like, "Oh my God, it was crazy."
It was crazy, and of course, Mike Smith, another Chicago guy, was lead alto in that band, second alto, excuse me, to Andy Fusco for a number of years before he left to go with Sinatra.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So a lot of Buddy alumni in Chicagoland area.
Well, what was that like when you got on that band? Because we're talking about people, you know, tell me if you don't like absolutely hate what I'm playing, you know, like what Victor Lewis told you. I mean, right, what was that like? Would Buddy tell you exactly like you suck? I mean, what are you playing? Was that a good learning experience for your first gig, or was it like, oh my God, this is a nightmare?
It was everything. It was all of those things. listen, I wasn't going to go on the band. I was at Eastman studying classical trumpet, and you know, I needed to finish the year. I needed to, and they had asked me a couple of times to come on, and I said no a couple of times because I'd heard the stories about the, you know, yelling and stuff like that, and I frankly was just a little reticent to do it. And then they came to Monroe College in Rochester, where the school was. And it was like the last gig, and then there was 2 weeks off. Mm-hmm. And then they were going to go back out. Come to the gig. You know, you listen to the gig, meet Buddy, and if you like what you hear. So I had this like little backstage pass, you know, my 20-year-old schoolboy look, yeah, looks and all that. And so I got the backstage pass, which put me over by his Chinese cymbal, which was to the right off the bandstand backstage. Mm-hmm. And he started out with Wind Machine.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, and I just, I think I leapt off the ground about 6 or 7 inches. And then I was just looking for a phone because I needed to call my parents to tell them I was going on to be rich. I mean, that's how amazing the energy was and what an incredible force of nature that man was.
Yeah.
So, you know,
that's the kind of thing, though.
Wouldn't trade it for the world, that experience.
I'm always curious because, I mean, you have these experiences, and outside of, you know, the not so fun part, but with the band itself and that energy, you brought up that energy. I mean, and I know you've taught, you've been a professor at University of Miami, I think, and a couple other universities and things. So you're dealing with a lot, yeah, of younger students and students that are in college. This day and age, you don't get those experiences anymore as like a 19 or 20 or 21-year-old to be able to go out with a band that is playing like top, you know, massive amounts of high-energy stuff. You cannot phone anything in, and it's from note one to the last note of the set, and if you're not hanging, you're not hanging. And it's,
yeah, and, you know, it's living on the bus and playing one-nighters is what it is. And,
yeah,
and that part of the industry has all but disappeared, unfortunately, for, you know, it's necessary for everything to evolve. So it's time to move on to the next thing, I suppose, and find that energy in another form.
Well, you're right, though, because that's the only way to get that feeling, right? Is get on the bus, get out, warm up a little bit, and bam, it's go time, right? And then you get on,
yeah,
the bus.
And this is the routine part of it. That's really, yeah, a big part of it, because you get comfortable, you know, and you have all that time to yourself, sitting on the bus thinking about, you know, how you performed that night into the next day, and your life revolves around the 2 45-minute sets.
Yeah.
So right there, just that focus.
Yeah.
You know, well, and everybody, you can't help but be on the same page with folks. You're living on the bus with them.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, but then
it would behoove you.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, that kind of an experience, and then you went back to school, but then after school, you got out and you went right back on the road again, right? Who were you on the road with right out of school again?
I decided, I really tried my best to become a college educator, and as soon as I got in there, I wanted to revolutionize jazz education, because I saw cats learning chord scale theory with the horns in their cases and stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh man, that's really not the way to do it. That's not the way that anybody did it. And so I started, you know, ruffling some feathers and realized the college experience, at least in those days, was not going to be for me. So I moved on in 1995, moved from Miami where I was living, mm-hmm, and just moved to New York City. Within about 8 months, I got a call to go play with Ray Charles, and I just jumped on it and did a year with him.
Yeah.
So the next year I didn't go back. And
that was a lot. I mean, with Ray, that's an intense situation too. There's a lot of traveling and stuff involved and all that. So I'd imagine after a year, you're probably like, okay, I need a little breather, right?
Yeah, it was really crazy. And I did want to come back and stay in New York, but I needed that experience really bad.
Mm-hmm.
I needed, there were so many things that we could talk for 3 hours just on Mr. Charles alone. when I came back, I was lucky I didn't go back on the road because I took an audition for Ray Barretto's small group and got to be a member of New World Spirit for 6 years.
Yeah.
And that took me all over the world as well. But we're almost in the like the context of a Latin version of Art Blakey's band. So, which was exactly where I wanted to be.
It's like that's like perfect for you.
It was perfect. It was perfect. Perfect situation. I adored Ray Barretto from playing in a band called La Moraya, which was a salsa band in Rochester, but also from hearing him on a sideman on, you know, records like So Much Guitar by Wes Montgomery and on and on and on. That list goes. He's actually on Skydive.
Oh.
And I had forgotten that he was actually on Skydive because he did all those tracks for Atlantic in the 60s. And I listened, about 2 years ago, I pulled out my LP of Skydive and put it on for a student. And I heard the conga sound. I said, holy, isn't that's Ray Barretto. I had completely forgotten that Barretto was on that record. It was after 6 years, you know, you hear a sound for a couple seconds, and it's like, oh, that's Ray. You know,
yeah,
that's his sound.
What was that like going out on the road with you know, you were on the road with Buddy and you know, larger bands like that, but being on the road for 6 years consistent, right? So you're playing with somebody consistently for 6 years, and he's a legend. So I mean, you're going out and you're playing some of the prime, you know, jazz and Latin clubs and festivals and everything else throughout the world. But you're in a smaller group, and that group, especially with that type of music, I mean, you guys had to really lock in. I mean, it had to be incredible. And I don't know if you could ever have that experience again in this day and age, right?
I would hope so. And I would strive to have that if I was a younger gentleman trying to get about, or a young lady trying to get about, you know, being a jazz musician in this 2021 environment. I would submit that it can be done. I would say that, you know, but we just have to reinvent ourselves, you know? Hey, man, you know,
I think COVID-19 is helping to reinvent a lot of things in the music industry. So maybe this whole thing is going to come full circle, and there are going to be groups like that, that play for longer periods of time together. But you know how difficult it is with jazz musicians to pin them down and have them stay in one band for a long period of time to really get that chemistry happening.
Yeah. Sort of the day and age of projects. I get that. And I understand it as well. I always have sort of gone with the theory in the back of my head. I suppose you could say it's overly optimistic, but that the more you starve human beings of the organic live interaction, witnessing the live organic interaction of jazz musicians playing together, the more eventually there's going to be a demand for it. In other words, that pendulum is going to swing as well. And people are going to come back and they're going to have a yearning for it like they never did before. So
I think you're right. I think you're right. And I know that you deal with a lot of different musicians during this COVID-19 situation. I'm sure you've had a lot of conversations and stuff, and you're seeing a lot of the live stream, and you're probably doing some online or Zoom teaching or all of that.
Oh, yeah.
Because all the universities went on, right? But I mean, I feel like this day and age, and I'm curious to get your take on it because of all your experiences, but I think this day and age has, number one, the silver lining is going to come out is that there's a lot of musicians that are going to find their way around technology that they would have never found their way around technology just because they were used to teaching in person and playing gigs. So that might be a good thing where they can also figure out different ways to distribute their music and connect with a larger audience outside of their normal comfort zone.
Yes, that's exactly right. We've got to use technology. And, you know, there's some great opportunities to be had here. And just don't discount, you know, people, you gotta be creative and resourceful. And lest we forget, we are actually in a period of great, prolific times in the world of jazz music. It's just not really being recognized or supported by the media in general, but it's happening. I mean, I'm in New York. You're a creative musician. Every time you go out, you get inspired. Mm-hmm. You hear somebody who plays circles around you, and not just technically either. You know,
right.
I mean, it's amazing what's going on right now. And Ira Sullivan, I gotta mention Ira because he's my mentor, my main man. And
Ira.
I just talked to him the other day in Miami. He just turned 89. He's doing great. So he wants to shout out to everybody.
Oh, that's awesome.
In the Chicagoland area. 89 years young.
Isn't that amazing? And, you know, every time I see Ira when he's up here, because he always does the Jazz Fest, and he's always up here playing seven nights at the showcase and leading jam sessions and stuff. And
yeah,
you would never know he's 89, man.
Yeah, he's a force of nature, man. And he used to drive me around in his Silverado down in Miami. And he used to say to me, look, they've been prophesizing the end of jazz since before there was jazz, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he would take me through it, you know. If you can hear him too, right? You know, first it was the wax cylinders, you know. Then it was the 78s. Then it was the war, you know. Then it was the big bands, or maybe not in that order. And then, you know, then it was Elvis. Then it was the Beatles. And then he would always end with, "But we're still here. We're still here. We're playing," you know. So these people are in our midst, man, and this music is alive and well.
Yeah.
Through
yeah.
Ira, through a kid in school, mm-hmm. you know, through people like Stacy Dillard, you know.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I also think that live music thing, you know, from the technology point of view, you expand your audience, but then there's nothing like seeing jazz specifically, or even Latin jazz, in a live setting. You cannot get that feeling on YouTube, you know?
No, man. And that's really the conundrum. That's really where you've hit the nail on the head in terms of what the greatest challenge is.
Yeah.
And that is to try to use technology in such a way that we can actually play in different spaces electronically in real time live.
Mm-hmm.
I've been told that it's impossible by some, and I've been told that it is possible by others. Mm-hmm. And I could go into a whole technological spiel that my 16-year-old son is explaining to me why it's not possible, but I think I'll spare you that conversation. It has to do with wires and where the relay system is and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah, with cloud, so, and it goes latency. Up and comes down. Latency, yeah, latency.
But, yeah, latency, but, the evil enemy of the live musician.
But I think that's good, though, because it forces people to go and see it live. And the thing that I, you know, it's almost like, and I'm thinking about this lately, but it's almost like jazz, right? If we're talking about jazz and Latin jazz and all that stuff. And then you have pop rock, you have, you know, all of those things, which actually, you know, and hip hop and all that, which I love. I love all of that. But they can create beats. It can be electronic, and they can do it, and they can push it out, and it sounds fine. The live jazz thing, or the Latin jazz, or anything similar to that, you need to experience it in person. And I was telling somebody, it's like, it's almost like what they always say about hockey. You know, you can watch hockey on TV, but boy, until you go and see it live, you're not getting the full effect of what that is. And
yeah,
it's almost like
right.
the same thing with jazz, is that you can get a live stream performance. You can see this stuff, but then you walk into a jazz club, get the feel, get the smell, get the vibe. You walk in, get the lighting, you sit down, they start playing. Completely different experience, and hopefully that's
really
going to expand the audience out, so people go and take a chance, right?
That's right, and the of course the thing is that in this current situation, I'm speaking of the pandemic, of course the jazz musicians are hit hard and everywhere else because we rely so heavily on playing with each other in mm-hmm. real time, and so you know you just got to hope for a vaccine or some kind of a wave where we can be safe to go out and play with one another again. When you go back to the other way of doing it, you can, while we're waiting, we can do all sorts of beautiful creative things. Like if you go back to Brian Wilson mm-hmm. and the Beatles and Frank Zappa, these people were the pioneers of what I would call the one-way street, where, you know, you have a drummer lay it down and then you've got a multi-track recording and you just layer that multi-track recording. And then you have a track that you're playing with, that nobody's interacting with you, but you can put your two cents in and work with that track.
Yeah.
Then you can send that along to the next person. Of course, this has been the way things have been being done really since the late 60s in pop music and most other genres.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something we're probably going to have to embrace and make the best of while we wait.
Well, and I think if jazz musicians get a hold of that concept, it's probably going to expand out really quickly, because we're going to be looking at it completely differently than if we were thinking of it from one genre of music. So it's an exciting time, like what you said, and you know, but we can't wait to get out and see live music again. That's for sure. That's for sure.
For sure, man. For sure. You know, this is the first time in 40, at least easily 40 years that I've gone more than even a couple of weeks without, you know, interacting live with another musician. Isn't that crazy, man? It's been 7 or 8 weeks now.
Yeah. I mean, it's really crazy. This is unprecedented. This has never happened before. And let's hope that we can make sure it never happens again once we get out of this whole situation.
Hello. Thank you, Mike Jeffers. Listen to those words.
That's right. That's right.
Yes, sir.
Well, I want to make sure we tell everybody to head over to johnbailey.com. We're going to link everything up as well. You've got to check out the new recording, Can You Imagine? And it's really, hopefully, now that all of our viewers and listeners to the podcast and all that hear the concept behind this, they go and take a listen to this, because now their ears will be open and they'll be listening to what John's been talking about. And it makes it even more interesting to listen to, because now you know the premise, the concept, and you can hear some of the themes that he talks about throughout the suite and other tunes on this recording. So congratulations on this recording, John. I really appreciate you jumping on today. But I would be remiss if I didn't bring up, you did a recording with, well, first you played with Buddy Rich, One Crazy Drummer. You played another, you did another recording with another crazy drummer, Chicagoan, Bear Deems.
That's right.
Who I got to know towards the end of his life, and he was probably just as crazy when you knew him as when I knew him. So how did that come
awesome.
About? Oh, he's crazy.
Well, yeah, listen, two words, rather. Brad Good.
Oh, no kidding.
I went to high school with Brad Good in East Lansing, Michigan. He was a senior when I was a freshman. Mm-hmm. He was friends with my sister who played trumpet. I knew him since I was 11. And when I came to Chicago during these, you know, professor days, you know, yeah. I would come up from Miami and do these clinics and stuff. And I was in Chicago, and Brad said, why don't you come down to the Elbow Room? You remember the Elbow Room?
Oh, yeah. He played there every week. Barrett did.
And
yeah.
I played there with Barrett, and he would do one of these. I mean, Barrett was a virtuoso. Mm-hmm. He was the fastest drummer in the world. Brad used to take me to his house. He had rare footage of Red Rodney playing with like, yeah, I mean, it was just amazing, you know, just to be in the same room with this cat. But the way he played was a whole other level, like the same level as Buddy Rich, but without as much angst. There's something else going on there. Yeah. Of course, he was Louis Armstrong's drummer, so come on, man.
Right.
So, yeah, that experience. So the routine was, and this is how the title of the album came about, and I hope I think I can say this word on the air. He would do one of this thing to do a press roll and get all around the instrument and do his pyrotechnics, and he would stop, flap, right down the snare drum, right? And he'd turn to the band, he'd say, how do you like it so far? And our line was, sucks. And then he would cue the last note, and that was the end of the tune, you know. So that's Barrett in a nutshell, man. And so that's the album is called How Do You Like It So Far.
Yeah. Oh man, that's great. That's awesome. You and I could tell Bear Deem stories probably for another hour.
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to tell them, you know.
Well, no, none of us should tell half of them.
Explicit language.
Of course. He came into Andy's one night. You can appreciate this. And he comes into Andy's one night, and it was towards the end. But I had known him for a while. I knew him from when he was playing at the Elbow Room. And he comes into Andy's, and I'm sitting there because somebody else was playing. And he comes up, and he punches me in the arm, and he sits down next to me. And I'm looking, and he's got a hospital bracelet on and an IV bag. I go, what are you doing? He goes, I was at the hospital for the past 2 weeks. I couldn't take it anymore. I'm like, okay. Should you be here?
Oh,
he's
man.
Like, don't worry, I'm not gonna play tonight. I'm like, okay, all right, Barrett, no problem. But you know,
yeah,
he just loved
tenacity,
the music,
right?
So much, man. He loved the music, and he wanted to be around it constantly. And that's what I remember about him too, man. He was, you know, he's incredible. You must have been in that. You must have played that band. Frank Catalano was in that band. I don't know.
He sure was, man.
Yeah. I used to play with Frank all the time too. So yeah, there's a lot of Chicago connections with your background. I love it.
There are a ton of them, and you know, I love Lincoln Ave, and I love DePaul, and I played with Ed Palermo for years, and Ed's a DePaul graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And of course Ira, and you know, the list goes on.
Yeah.
I really love the Chicagoland area, and you want to see how deep it goes for me. My first trip ever from East Lansing on a train by myself was into Union Station to meet my grandmother. My grandmother lived in Deerfield, mm-hmm. and my grandfather was a physics teacher at Neutrier High School.
Oh, no kidding.
No kidding, man. So it runs deep. My father was born in Normal, Illinois.
Oh, that's awesome. Then you know the area. So hopefully when all this stuff calms down, we'll get you in over to the Jazz Showcase or the Green Mill or something, and we can see you perform live here in Chicago at some point. That'd be awesome.
That sounds like a lot of fun. I'd love to revisit Chicago. It's been too long.
Yeah. Well, John, thanks for jumping on today, man. I really appreciate you taking the time, and congratulations on the new recording. And, you know, everybody head over to johnbailey.com. And, you know, like I said, hopefully we'll see you here live in Chicago sooner rather than later. And, you know, who knows, maybe we'll bring Brad Good back and you guys could have a reunion concert or something.
Oh, man, that would be a lot of fun. That would be a lot of fun. Hey, listen, and I would be remiss, Mike Jeffers, if I didn't say happy birthday to you.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
Happy birthday to Mike Jeffers, to you and yours and all of your fans.
Well, I appreciate you saying that very much. I've got a wild evening planned. I'm planning on going outside and sitting on my patio deck and drinking half a glass of wine. So it's going to get nuts.
Awesome. And if you feel like having a second half, don't worry about it.
All right. Since you said so, done. I'm drinking a full glass of wine tonight, man. It's over.
All right.
Hey, thanks, John.
Go
take
straight
care.
To bed.
That's right. That's right. Take care. Stay safe. And hopefully we'll see you here in Chicago once everything breaks loose with the COVID-19 and we can all get back to normal.
Yeah, from your mouth to God's ears, my man.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, John.
Thanks so much, Mike. Thank you so much, man.
Take care. All right. Bye. John Bailey. Wow. You know, what a super nice guy. I'm telling you, and his recording, you won't be disappointed. The recording, it's really, man, there's a lot of different genres, a lot of different styles incorporated in there, but that's his playing, that's his voice. And hopefully by listening to what you know, his description of the recording and the whole concept behind it, you got something out of it, and you can go check it out, johnbailey.com. Tomorrow we have got an action-packed show. Tomorrow we're starting early. We're going to be doing 5:30 p.m. start time. We're going to have Darren Scores and Michelle Thomas on, previewing their live performance live stream at 7:30 p.m. tomorrow night. So that is going to be at 5:30. And then at 6 o'clock, we're finally going to get to sit down and talk with, well, virtually, unfortunately, Matt Ullery is going to be on. We've been trying to connect. We've been trying to do an interview, a feature interview for the magazine. COVID-19 hit. Everything got shut down as far as that goes. But we're going to have Matt on. We're going to talk all about his career, all about his incredible recordings, compositions, performances, his recording label, his record label. We've had a couple of artists that he has on the label on in the past. It'll be great to actually have the person running the label on and a whole lot more. So that's going to be tomorrow at 6. So we've got 5:30, Michelle Thomas, Darren Scorza, 6 p.m., Matt Ullery, and you know, what can I say? We're going to have a jam-packed. We've got a great week coming up as well. I'm going to announce all of that stuff, but we've got a bass summit with Frank Russell on Friday, and Daryl Jones from the Rolling Stones is going to be joining us, along with Chuck Webb and Bear Williams and a host of other bassists. That's our Friday summit. And, I can't even remember right now. I'll announce everything a little bit later on tonight. Of course, you can see all the past episodes at ChicagoMusicRevealed.com, ChicagoJazz.com. And of course, I'm also the program director at the Epiphany Center for the Arts. So check out EpiphanyShy.com for all of our upcoming performances. We're going to be launching things starting in September. So you want to get on the mailing list so you can get all of the discounts and all of the special order ticketing opportunities for our fall season. So check all that stuff out. All right. I appreciate everyone giving me the happy birthday love here. I've seen my Facebook feed is blowing up, which I cannot, you know, thank everyone enough. I'm going to go through and thank everyone personally, but I'm telling you right now on the show. And of course, I see some of my favorite people there chiming in on the comments, giving me a happy birthday throughout the interview. So thank you so much. I am going to go and chill out now. So hopefully everybody has a good evening. Stay safe. Stay inside, of course, tomorrow night right here, 5:30 p.m. And we're going to have a great show tomorrow night. But until then, stay safe. Stay inside. let's hope all of this stuff ends soon so we can get back to a wonderful city of Chicago and chill out, and all of us can work together. All right, stay safe. Until tomorrow, I will see you at the next broadcast.